The Deadbolt Mystery Society presents The Warwick Recordings, a story about secrets and how they are uncovered in a strange neighborhood in an even stranger town.
This is Knox Carter, and we're getting close to the end now. We're on Warwick Recording number 9. It's getting exciting, don't you think? Nothing else of note happened during the dinner party. Every now and then I notice Allie watching me from across the table. For the most part, the rest of dinner conversation was limited to politics, the weather, the recent disappearances of wayward women that were plaguing the city, and inflation. I only pretended to hear most of it. My mind was racing with thoughts of everything I had learned that night, and all the secrets I might learn later when I got to talk to Allie in a different, unguarded setting. Eventually, after stuffing myself on Virginia Barker's pot roast and cheesecake, I decided that I couldn't wait any longer. I politely excused myself for the evening and asked Allie if she was ready for that drink. She popped up out of the chair as if it were spring-loaded. I told everyone how lovely the evening had been, said it was great meeting everyone, and made my escape with Allie not far behind. We crossed Virginia's lawn and headed over to my car. Neither of us spoke until we were both in the car. "Took you long enough," Allie said, slamming her door. "I thought we were never leaving." "I was trying to be polite," I explained as I pulled out of the driveway. "We don't have time to be polite," she explained to me. "We need to get you out of town." I thought I addressed that already. "I'm not leaving. I won't be forced out of my home." "You might change your mind when you see what I have to show you," Allie said.
"Oh, really?"
"Yes," she said. "Take a right at the end of the street, then go down 2 blocks and take a left."
"Where are we going?" I asked.
"My house," she said. "I have something to show you."
"It's our first date," I said with a smile. "I'm not that kind of guy."
"Ha ha," she said. "Very funny. You're a regular comedian."
"As if."
"As if what?"
"You're not my type."
"What does that mean? Why? What's wrong with me?"
"Oh, nothing at all. I just usually go for older men. Besides, I read the papers and watch the news. There's a psycho on the loose. Haven't you heard? Maybe you're him."
"You'll be relieved to know that I haven't killed any young women today."
"Well, thank God for small favors, I guess.
For what it's worth, I wouldn't even call this a date. There's nothing romantic about it."
"I'm glad to hear that," I said. "Your aunt has been scheming to get us together. Maybe you should tell her I'm not your type."
"There's a lot of scheming going on. All of that with my aunt was just a pretense for getting you in front of the group. I feel like you aren't going to be prepared for what I'm about to show you."
"The suspense writer part of me is definitely intrigued," I said.
"Okay, now pull into the driveway of the house at the end with the blue shutters. That's me. Give me a couple minutes. I'll wave you in when I'm sure the coast is clear."
At that point, Allie went inside. After a few minutes, she returned to the door and motioned for me to come inside the house. I exited my car and ran in without hesitation. It's strange how I never even thought to question her motives or wonder why she wanted to help me so much. Never once did I consider her a threat. Maybe it's just easy to follow a beautiful woman. That line of thinking, of course, had gotten me into trouble more times than I could count. But off I went in search of answers. Allie didn't say anything at first. She simply motioned for me to be quiet and led me down a long hallway to a sitting room, furnished with a plush blue sofa, a recliner to match, and several canvas-colored chairs that had been positioned around a mahogany card table. The room looked as if it might have been used as a game room. Perhaps Allie and her friends used a space to play spades, poker, gin rook, or some other card game. But she wasn't concerned with any of the room's furnishings, only a bronze wall sconce. With a twist of her wrist, she turned a sconce on the wall, and immediately a panel on the opposite wall popped open, showing a series of steps descending beneath the house. It was obvious that my understanding of the pathways that ran beneath the neighborhood were correct. Many of the houses in Warwick Court had an access point to the tunnels. and to the Owl King's shrine. Because I had already visited the tunnels, I knew how they ran and had a general idea of which way we were going in relation to my house as we descended. Allie seemed to know these pathways better than me, and once she reached the hub that was the room where the Owl King totem stood, she wasted no time heading down one of the hallways branching off it. We walked for what seemed like half an hour. By the time we were done, I wasn't entirely certain we were beneath Warwick Court any longer. Allie found another set of steps that you wouldn't have noticed or seen if you didn't know where they were, and we ascended. Part of me was frightened we were going to emerge in someone's living room. Part of me didn't know what to think. I was just blindly following this woman that I barely knew through a series of subterranean tunnels. What could possibly go wrong? When we emerged from the passageway, I realized that we had actually come up through the floor. I wasn't sure where we were at first, but I was immediately filled with a strange, overwhelming sense of dread. We were in a room filled with illuminated glass cases. Inside those cases were what appeared to be Native American artifacts, totems, tapestries, weapons, and charms. A lighted sign over a doorway read, "Supernatural Shamans of the Southwest."
"Okay, it's safe for us to talk now," Allie whispered. "The cult has ways of monitoring the passageways that run beneath the neighborhood."
"Where are we?" I asked. "What are you talking about? What cult? You're going to have to start explaining some of this to me."
"The tunnels we've been using are far older than Warwick Court," Allie said. "No one is really sure who built them. At one point, they were used as our own local version of the Underground Railroad. At another point, they were used by smugglers and hypnose dealers. Human traffickers have used them on occasion. But then the cult took over and have had a stranglehold on the tunnels ever since. Mostly the people who used the tunnels before have all used them because they were secret. The Court of Moloch uses them because of the energy that courses through them."
"Like what Carl was saying earlier?" I asked.
"Exactly," Allie confirmed.
"The tunnels run underneath a variety of interesting Valley Falls locations that are all built in close proximity to the ley lines that Carl was talking about.
The tunnel we took led us to this paranormal museum called Museum Nocturnus. The museum is a collection of cursed objects, haunted items, and weird magical junk. Surely it can't be a coincidence that Museum Nocturnus is built so close to a major source of unseen subterranean mystical energy, can it? Museum Nocturnus is one of the top 10 places to visit in Valley Falls, according to TripAdvisor. They focus heavily on the supernatural and paranormal."
"Okay, let's say I buy into all of this," I said. "What does any of this have to do with anything? What does all this talk about a cult? Why'd you bring us to a Native American exhibit on shamans? I don't understand any of this."
"The cult has existed in one form or another since the colonial days," Allie explained. "They call themselves the Court of Moloch and are dedicated to a god who demands blood. They borrowed a lot of traditions, beliefs, and superstitions from a lot of ancient belief systems, including the Babylonians, Sumerians, Canaanites, and those of the local Native American tribes. Then they took those beliefs and superstitions and perverted them, twisting them into something that bore no resemblance to the source. In many cultures, owls are a sign of wisdom. They're known as fierce hunters. The Pueblo associate the owl with the god of death and spirit of fertility. They associate owls with the cycle of existence and life. The Court of Moloch, however, developed a series of beliefs over the years that merged Olmec human sacrifice rituals, rebirth beliefs of groups like the Pawnee, and the magic and sorcery of certain shamans who were drawn to the darkness. For certain clandestine groups, owls were associated with witches and the darkest of magics. The Navajo believe that owls are heralds of death and destruction. What nearly all the Native American groups agree on, however, is that the owls stand in that barrier between this life and the next. Some think they're symbols of life. Others think they bring death. That door, in some cases, is one and the same."
"English, please," I said.
"The Court of Moloch believed that through human sacrifice rituals, like the kind performed by the Canaanite worshippers of Moloch, they could restore life to the dead or bestow the life force of the young to the very old to prolong existence. As I explained, the group has been around for a very long time. And they've had moderate success. However, when the theory of ley lines and mystical points of energy convergence came into popularity, The group adopted those ideas and merged them with what they already knew and had learned from centuries of experimentation. The fact that Valley Falls sits on a major ley line convergence point suddenly made lots of things possible that hadn't been before, like rebirth, like turning back the hands of Father Time. I studied Allie carefully to see if there was any trace of a smile. Was this a joke? She wasn't laughing. "Do you know how crazy that sounds?" I asked. "I do. Trust me, I do. So, what does any of that have to do with me, my house, the Owl King, or Warwick Court?" "Mary is supposed to be next. She doesn't have much time. That's why they started with you almost immediately. They waited too long with Uncle Harold, and the Falk family is alive now because of it. Uncle Harold, unfortunately, didn't make it. But there's still a chance for Mary." "Mary, the little shriveled-up lady that could barely walk," I said. "Yep, that Mary," Allie confirmed. "The Falks were supposed to be sacrificed to restore her." "Restore her? You mean give her back her youth?" "Something like that." "And we're here in a paranormal museum in a Native American exhibit looking for what?" Allie hesitated before speaking. "It's a long shot, but I hope there's something here that will keep you alive. You're the one they'll be coming for. You're the one who'll need protection." "Protection against a bunch of senior citizens. I think I can take care of myself." "You don't get it. There's so much more to them than you realize, and when it comes down to a matter of their life or yours, they're going to kill you without blinking." "So let's say that I'll buy into all this. Maybe this group of Shady Pines rejects believes everything you've told me. That doesn't mean there's anything to it at all. When you peel back all the layers, they're still just a bunch of old-timers who are subject to delusions. Just trust me on this." I sighed, not really knowing what else to do. "Okay, fine. I followed you this far. What are we looking for here?" "Do you see that glass case in the far corner of the exhibit? The one with a talisman made from eagle feathers. That's what we want. Owls are apex predators, and one of their only natural enemies is the eagle. Eagles are regarded by Native Americans as brave, strong, holy. The talisman will protect you." "Against what?" "If you're lucky, against the Owl King." "Stealing this is a crime," I offered, not really sure what else to say. "Not stealing it will likely mean you die tonight." "Okay, so explain one more thing to me. Why are you helping me? If I believe everything you've told me, which is bonkers, by the way, then there has to be a legitimate explanation for why you would choose to betray your own aunt and try and keep me alive. Let's just say this has been going on too long, and my conscience is getting the better of me. Now, are we doing this or not?" "So we stole the talisman made from eagle feathers from the museum and headed back through the tunnels to Allie's house. I didn't believe in any of this mumbo-jumbo, but Allie seemed convinced it was real. I couldn't allow myself to believe any of what I'd been told, because there was a big block of time in my life where I had given in to delusions and became convinced they were real. A reward for my belief was a one-way ticket to Saturn Hills Asylum. I couldn't allow myself to fall back into thinking that the impossible was somehow possible again. I knew where that road led, and I wasn't prepared to relive it. I thought it strange that no alarms went off when we removed the glass case from the artifact, but there was too much going on to consider any of that. At a later point, I would read a book about Museum Nocturnus by an author named Jason Brannan that would convince me that I had dodged a bullet, because the museum is apparently a very dangerous place for thieves. It's possible Allie knew a way to circumvent all of that, just as she seemed to know a way to avoid being murdered by a bunch of old-timers. I thought about Mary, shriveled up and having the countenance of a toad. It was possible she'd been young and beautiful once, but she seemed like the type that had always been 90 years old. The fact that Allie believed all this made me question some things about her. Perhaps I should have thought all this through a little better. I'd committed a crime because she told me to, and now I was in even deeper than before. I decided I needed to go back to my own home and regroup. Allie asked me not to, since the house sat atop a major convergence of ley line energy, and that was the reason the owner of the house was always a target. But I wanted to clear my head and be in a space where I could think without interruption.
I could barricade myself into my room there like I had the first night of my stay and be reasonably certain of my safety. Allie kept begging me not to return to my house. In that moment, she reminded me of my ex-wife, which wasn't a good thing. I left Allie's home and headed back to my own. The walk back to my own house wasn't a long one, but in that time, something else happened that took me by surprise. A notification popped up on my phone indicating that I had a direct message on one of my social media platforms. When I pulled up the message, I was shocked to see that it was a reply from Stone Gardner, the journalist whose name had been written in one of the rules for the game as outlined by the Fox. I opened the message excitedly, only to find a short message and a photo. The reply read, "I investigated the story about your house and had to flee town to save my own life. Look at this photo carefully. Also, there is a set of coordinates behind one of the boards in your house. Don't be afraid to dig deep and take time to smell the roses." There wasn't time to consider the part of the message that dealt with coordinates and the field. The photo, instead, was what had my attention. I studied the image carefully and was amazed to see a group photo that looked more than 50 years old. Although I knew this could have been the work of an expert in Photoshop, I wasn't certain that was the case. And yet, the people in the picture were all familiar to me. Some, like Carl and Virginia, looked younger than they had at the dinner party. There was another woman I thought might have been Mary in her younger years. But hers wasn't the face that stopped me in my tracks. Rather, it was the man in the center of the photo who was wearing his best seersucker suit and smiling back at the camera like the great Gatsby himself. It was my realtor, Preston Adams. He hadn't aged a day. The caption beneath his photo simply read, "The Lazarus Group, 1971. Come back next time and hear all about what I learned from the information Stone Gardner provided. Trust me, you won't want to miss it. And with so much talk about secrets, I'll let you in on my biggest one in the next recording. This has been Knox Carter with the Warwick Recordings.
The Warwick Recordings are presented by the Deadbolt Mystery Society. Written by Jason Brannan. Edited by David Alderman. Narrated by Glenn Payne. Sound designed and mixed by Glenn Payne. Executive producers Jason Brannan and Sean Brannan. You can support us by reviewing the Warwick Recordings on the platform where you found us and by sharing this podcast with others. If you enjoyed the Warwick Recordings, we think you would also like our puzzle-solving mystery games, which are found at deadboltmysterysociety.com. Thank you for listening. Until next time.